Whether you're coming or going, you depend on us to keep you company. We depend on you for financial support to make that possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to help make great programs possible on WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
In sports, the Associated Press is reporting that former number one ranked tennis player Kim Clijsters has asked the U.S. Open about receiving a wild card for this year's tournament as part of her comeback plans. The 25-year-old Belgian says she will announce her 2009 plans at a news conference Thursday. A person who works at the U.S. Tennis Association tells the AP there have been conversations between a tournament official and representative of Clijsters, who retired in 2007. Clijsters was the U.S. Open champion in 2005. Ball State was the story of the opening weekend of the NCAA women's tournament after knocking off two-time defending national champion Tennessee. Now it's back to business. The Cardinals face fourth-seeded Iowa State in the second round of the Berkeley Regional tonight. The Chicago Bulls' mediocre march toward the playoffs continues. Chicago nearly blew a double-digit fourth-quarter lead against the worst team in the East, but hung on to beat the Washington Wizards 101-99 last night. That leaves the Bulls five games under 500, but good enough to hold down the eighth and final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. Tonight, Chicago hosts Detroit. And the St. Louis Blues are back home tonight to take on the Los Angeles Kings. A win tonight would give the Kings a sweep of their season series against the Blues. In the 42-year history of this series, the only season in which the Kings have won every meeting came in the 2005-2006 season. That's sports.
Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at TNOL.com.
Next time on PRI's The World, some rebels and paramilitaries are leaving Colombia's civil war and taking to the stage. It's part of a government program that trains former fighters to be musicians. That story from Colombia in the day's news coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock. There's a little-noticed public health crisis brewing in Illinois. It's not especially sexy, but it's serious. It's connected to life-threatening ailments, nutrition, even job prospects. The problem is access to dental care. Illinois has the third largest underserved population in the country. The few clinics that treat poor people are overwhelmed. Now they're bracing for a new flood of patients as more people lose their jobs, Gabriel Spitzer reports.
The clinic at the University of Illinois at Chicago's Dental College opens at 7:30 in the morning, sharp. Well before that, at 6:45, the sun is just peeking over the horizon. About 30 people have already queued up outside the doors. This is not a happy line.
It's like a very dull throbbing.
It's kind of a dull pain, so it's really weird.
I can't sleep at nighttime. I haven't been able to sleep the past 2 days.
I mean, like the 1967 war between the Israelis and the Arabs is going on in my mouth.
The folks up front got here at 5:30 in the morning. They're here because this clinic treats people on public aid and some with no insurance at all. This is Michael Angelakis.
Can't afford the dentist no more. It's just, they tripled in the last 15 years. It's a racket.
What other options are available to you besides paying out of pocket or coming here?
Nothing. You got to either come here or go to Cook County.
By 7:30, the line has stretched to about 75 people. A security guard turns a key and people file in. It's orderly this morning, but Dr. Gary Drejos says some days there are tussles at the door. The clinic sees about 40 urgent care patients a day. The rest get a little sympathy and a list of other places to go.
There's very little out there, and we try to update these lists constantly, and as we do, we find out that most of them are overbooked just like we are.
Drejos says people drive hundreds of miles to come here. More than half of Illinois counties have a dentist shortage, according to the feds. It's not a new problem, but it's gotten worse. Chicago lost two of its three dental schools. Cook County has slashed dental services. Now, just one in 10 dentists regularly sees Medicaid patients, leaving Illinois with a much bigger share of underserved people than the nation as a whole. Dentists say the problem starts with the paltry checks they get for treating poor people.
The Medicaid reimbursement does not cover most dentists' overhead, so you're probably losing money.
Dr. David Kuamoto is president of the Chicago Dental Society, one of the groups lobbying for more state investment in oral health. Advocates want almost $100 million, a steep request right in the middle of a budget crisis. Their idea for how to pay for it? Tax sugary soft drinks. But there may be just too many competing priorities. Even Governor Pat Quinn, who's made oral health a pet project, didn't include a cash infusion in his proposed budget last week. Kuamoto says the shortage of care is pushing people into emergency rooms.
They're tying up the doctor's time, the staff's time, and it is a ripple effect that will affect the whole hospital system.
But if people don't get treatment somehow, they could wind up in the ER for something much more serious. Studies link bad oral health to heart disease, stroke, and low birth weight.
Blue number 23, if you can step right and move.
Inside the UIC clinic, the line has reconstituted in front of a check-in desk. The doors opened at 7:30. By 7:43, there's an announcement.
If you're in line for adult urgent care, our clinic is already full today. Try back one day this week.
It's so exasperating.
Elva Asselingier needs a tooth pulled badly, and there's no way she can afford a regular dentist.
I only make $1,235 a month. Sometimes I don't even have money for my medication or for food.
Asselingier is diabetic, and she has to use the bathroom a lot. That makes it kind of tough to wait in long lines. Now she'll have to come back tomorrow and do it again.
Today I really needed the care. I wanted to be here at 7. Maybe I have to get here at 6:30. Then if I get here at 6:30, I have to go pee. Where am I going to go? Tell everybody, get around me and hide me, and I'll do it like the dogs.
People here say when you're dealing with a serious toothache, you'll endure a lot. More and more, that means either higher bills or longer lines. For people with much more time than money, that's hardly a choice at all. I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
It's 2:47. 50 years ago this month, the Dalai Lama and thousands of his followers fled the Chinese invasion of Tibet. Their half-century of exile has carried what was once a very cloistered culture into the rest of the world. One of the more unusual aspects of that culture is the throat singing practiced by Tibet's Gyuto monks. Few have heard the monks singing. Anil Mundra reports.
It was 3 o'clock one morning in 1964, on the eve of the highest holiday in the Tibetan calendar. Renowned religion scholar Houston Smith awoke in a monastery in the foothills of the Indian Himalayas.
There fell upon my ear the holiest sound I have ever heard.
Professor Smith is a man who knows from holy. He was raised in China by missionaries and wrote the classic textbook, The World's Religions. But despite a lifetime of research, Smith says he was shocked and exulted at this sound. So much so that he went back to the monastery 3 years later with Voice of America engineers and made a recording. Smith had already made one rougher tape of the monks that he'd taken back to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and played for an equally flabbergasted colleague, an ethnomusicologist.
Why, the man just paced the floor in excitement, and at one point he clapped his palm to his forehead and said, "My God, I am hearing 9 overtones."
An overtone is also called a harmonic, so hearing 9 of them is kind of like hearing a 9-part harmony in a single voice. Now, most of us can't hear that many. Even fewer of us can sing that many.
That's a vocal miracle.
And that's Mickey Hart, one of the former drummers of the Grateful Dead. He caught wind of Houston Smith's tape in San Francisco in the late 1960s, and it, well, blew his mind.
My ear was filled with monks for many years.
Couldn't wait to share it with his bandmates.
I mean, wait till Garcia hears this. He's not going to believe it.
But even that sound that so impressed Mickey Hart was not the whole thing. Houston Smith's 1967 tape is limited by several factors. First of all, even the semi-pro recording gear he used couldn't capture all of the sound. And second, the number of voices. Smith only heard the remnants of the choir, the few monks that survived the perilous trek into India after the Chinese attacked their temple in 1959 and killed or imprisoned most of them. In the original Gyudo monastery, there were over 100 monks in the choir.
No one's really heard 100 monks outside of Lhasa, you know, in many years. And we overdubbed, and now there's over 100 voice choir here.
To recreate the sound of a full choir for this CD, Mickey Hart recorded each monk multiple times to make 10 voices sound like 100. One of the first Tibetan monks to make his name in the West as a musician was Nawang Kechog. He was nominated for a Grammy in 2001. He says these chants are among the most secret and sacred of Tibetan Buddhism. That's why they're so heavily layered and deliberately hard to understand.
To hide the words in general public, it's disguised in that kind of multitonic sound.
The Dalai Lama has said that it's okay for the monks to perform publicly because the chants mean things which, in his words, the ordinary eye can't perceive anyway. And it's important for the monks to go public. One of the ways the community's been able to stay alive in exile is through the patronage of enamored foreigners, or even just quizzical ones. Kechog says that when he used to live in New York, he would get funny looks when he tried to harmonize with the subway trains.
I started the chant, and then suddenly the train is gone. I'm still chanting, and the few people standing there, and they think that what's going on, you know?
But the curiosity of foreigners might be just what Tibetan exiles need. Proceeds from this CD go towards Tibet House, a New York-based foundation, and to build the Gyudo Monastery in exile in India. And there's another benefit, says Professor Houston Smith. This music can help the rest of us understand our world more fully.
There is more in heaven and earth than there is in your philosophy, as someone famous once said. This enlarged my understanding of human beings and what they are capable of.
For NPR News, I'm Anil Mundra.
And this is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 2:53. Henry Frayen is our technical director. Since Natasha Richardson's death last week, there's been talk about skiing accidents and the dangers of skiing. It's an issue that the law has grappled with and finds fairly easy. Commentator Amy Gaida explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
As I write this, we don't know for certain what happened to Natasha Richardson at the ski resort in Canada, or precisely what caused her epidural hematoma. But there seems to be agreement that she fell during a ski lesson on an easy hill, one of the so-called bunny hills. Skiing, simply put, can be dangerous. And usually when one undertakes a dangerous thing, one has assumed the risk of injury springing from that dangerous thing. A federal court in Missouri, for example, decided that a 16-year-old inexperienced skier who fell on the slopes and suffered brain damage couldn't successfully sue the ski resort for her injuries. If the resort had been negligent in some way, the court reasoned, then there might be liability because any risk created by the resort's negligent act would not be a risk inherent in the sport itself. But here, the court explained, the fact that the teenager was thrown 5 feet into the air after hitting some sort of bump was part of the skiing bargain. Experts had testified during the trial about a certain unpredictability in skiing and that inherent risks in the sport include losing control, falling, colliding with objects and other skiers, encountering variations in snow surface terrain, variable weather conditions, and low visibility. Those sorts of dangers are so obvious, they say, that no resort owner should be forced to pay should someone be injured because of them. Those dangers are even part of the statutes in some states. Utah, for one, suggests that all skiers must be aware of impediments like bare spots, forest growth, rocks, stumps, stream beds, cliffs, trees, and other objects, in addition to more general dangers. The same risk assumption holds true even when the skier is on the slopes for the very first time. A woman in Maine who fell on a bunny hill and who'd signed a contract containing language that she recognized that skiing has an inherent danger didn't prevail in her lawsuit. She'd argued that because she was such a novice, she relied more on statements made by her instructor. Assurances like there's nothing to worry about and that nothing bad would happen, even though the instructor knew at the time that there'd been a large number of injuries during the beginner's class. The court found that the instructor's words were simply statements of opinion and didn't negate the contract. Any other decision, the court wrote, would seem to imply that ski resorts had the duty to warn all beginning skiers of every possible type of injury. This is not to say that no one has ever sued a ski resort successfully. A beginning skier in Utah could sue because she argued that the contract she'd signed wasn't as clear as the law required, and that she'd been incorrectly advised that her old ski boots would be compatible with new bindings. We don't know for sure what happened to Natasha Richardson, and what happened after her fall regarding medical treatment may be more relevant than the fall itself. But the Washington Post reported that during last year's ski season, 53 people were killed while skiing or snowboarding in the U.S., and about 10,000 more suffered some sort of head injury. With those sorts of numbers, it's clear why the law is not generally amenable to skiing-related lawsuits. I'm Amy Gaida.
Amy Gaida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, March 24th, 2009. In the Northern Hemisphere, it should be possible to catch the blazing planet Venus low in the west just after sunset this evening.
And if sky conditions are just right, it should also be possible to catch Venus low in the east tomorrow, shortly before sunrise. Venus is nearly always in either one part of the sky or the other. Now, for a few days, it's visible as both a morning and an evening star.
That's because Venus will pass between us and the sun this Friday, March 27th. Usually we see Venus pass from evening sky to morning sky, or vice versa. But on Friday, Venus will swing 8 degrees north of the sun, the maximum amount possible. And it's because of its passage north of the sun that Venus will appear in both our morning and evening skies for the next few days.
So take advantage of this rare opportunity to catch Venus at both dusk and dawn as this sister planet transitions from our evening to our morning sky. You have to look very low in the sky for Venus, though. Remember, it'll go between us and the sun on Friday, so it's very near the sun now along our line of sight. You'll find Venus low in the west, just after sunset.
And low in the east, just before sunrise. For more on how northern viewers can see this Venus double feature, visit our website. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Joel Block for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose initiative on immigration, history, and policy presents World Migration and the Politics of Newness by Adam McCune on Monday, March 30th at noon at the Center for Advanced Study, 912 West Illinois in Urbana, online at www.cas.illinois.edu.
This is